noir means multiple things. Number one, there's film noir, which is a particular cinematic stylistic genre of storytelling. You want something that visually evokes film noir. Noir is also a kind of tonal attitude in storytelling. There's not comedy noir, to my knowledge, right? It tends to denote something serious, mysterious, ground level, and speaking to how, you know, the definition has become even more expanded, speaking to the Black experience.
Welcome to Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing with your host, John Robinson IV. Here we smash walls, demolish writer's block, and learn how to harness the true power of storytelling. Let's get started. Meet Joseph Illich, a prolific comics writer, editor, and visionary. His forthcoming projects are Harriet Tubman from HarperCollins and The Winterfields, a Harlem Renaissance crime noir to be published under Fair Square Comics. Joseph's editorial career began at Milestone, and he's worked with major publishers like DC Comics and Heavy Metal Magazine. This is the second time on Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing, so let's dive in and get some of this wisdom. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Beyond the Fourth Wall podcast. I'm your host, John Robinson IV, and with me today is Mr. Joe Illich. How's it going?
I'm all right. How are you doing, John?
Doing pretty good. And as I just mentioned prior to us starting, Joe was back on a very early episode of the podcast, which I truly appreciate, because just getting started off the ground with the podcast, having somebody as illustrious as Mr. Illich on the podcast is a really big boost. So I definitely appreciate the support when I was getting started, and I appreciate your support coming back on now.
Well, you're welcome, and glad to be back.
Wow. Talk about. Absolutely. So let's get right into it. So we've got some new books in tow, and these are big ones in my opinion. Like these are big ones. I'm like, one of the things that I am most afraid of in writing, and you can maybe help clear up some of my fear in this. I love telling stories. Any stories are I'm great with. I just love the idea of telling stories. It doesn't matter really where it's from, unless it's history. and history is scary because
100%.
It's like there is a certain responsibility on your shoulders. Both when, even if you're doing alternate history, even if you're doing like a fictional story and an alternate, there's still some aspects of that history that happened are facts because they are history. And then there are certain things that you want to make sure are accurate. So people who, there's going to be the camp that knows the history and they're going to be ready to fact check you on it. And there's the camp that doesn't know the history. You want to make sure that you're accurately portraying the history. So I want to first ask, what do you feel the responsibility or the weight of portraying that history? Like, what does that mean to you, or how does that feel to you? Like having to basically wade through that big history, I guess, hurdle.
It is exciting, and really, you know, I'm really jazzed by it because it's an opportunity for me to increase my knowledge and to learn, right? The weight that you're talking about, and, you know, it's a fair and accurate one, is getting information right. You do have a responsibility about how you portray the times, how you portray people, right? Because everything is connected and contextual. And so with that, that's where you have to love doing research. You have to love learning things, and research comes in a variety of forms. It's not just going through your favorite search browser and typing in a subject and checking what the first 20 links you get are. It's archival images. It's watching interviews. It's reading about people and things that surround the time period and the people that you're talking about, so you understand their context, you understand their conditions. One of the things that I learned just
like a simple thing is any piece of information you see online regarding a date, you want to verify that with at least two other sources. You want at least three sources to agree on a day and a year, because the internet is a crazy place and you will find one fact and you will see different years attributed for that fact. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Don't feel like, oh, I have this piece of information, I can go on to the next one. Verify it across multiple sources before you consider it legitimate. You want to vet it, right? Because to your point, there are going to be people who are going to be the experts on it. And there are going, and like you said, they will call you on it, right?
Right.
There are going to be people who are going to be learning about it from you for the first time, whether those are adults, college students, high school students, junior high school students. So you want to be responsible toward them as well. And another part of it is to what you said about the fear of history, which is natural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have to embrace it and learn to enjoy it.
Right. Right.
You have to learn to enjoy history and enjoy learning what social echoes and patterns and dynamics lead us to the present. Because one of the things that you learn is the time that you're living in is not particularly unique.
Right, exactly.
Right? There are echoes, there are dynamics that repeat themselves throughout history. And when you see that, it gives you an entirely new perspective on your present day life.
Right, right. No, I love that. Yeah, I see, and you breaking down the means of research is so, so very important. It is definitely not all about clicking the first the first few links. It's definitely sometimes open up some of those archives. I'm familiar like with things like PubMed and other academic journals and whatnot that are out there, depending on the type of research you're looking at, whether it's scientific or like we're talking about historical. There's real peer-reviewed publications out there that have their own, which are some of the best because they have some of their own. Those are already by nature peer. They have their own fact-checking within because they have to do their own fact-checking before they can even publish the articles to begin with.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you also have an opportunity if what you're working on makes this possible to visit museums.
Absolutely. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Visit museums, visit galleries. So that's exciting too, right? Yep. Just finding these different entry points of information and knowledge, you know, and what you may find in time is the big trick may be stopping, right? You may actually get caught in this black hole of doing more research and more research and more research. And at a certain point you have to stop.
Right. Right.
And then you actually have to do the writing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's always a big thing that comes up too. It's like, I'm working on that book. You're like, how many pages have you written? Oh, none. I'm still in the research phase, you know? And then you get that conversation for, you know, like for about a year. It's before you realize like, maybe I should actually put the pen to paper, you know?
Yeah. You have to kind of create a cutoff point for yourself. If you take in on a project now, certain projects you're given deadlines and the deadlines dictate the cutoff point. If you have the freedom to create your own schedule, then yes, you want to create a point at which you say, okay, I'm going to break off from the research. Now I have to have the confidence that I have collected enough that I can start really diving into this.
Right, right. And I think that's also good, I think, because in my experience, every time, even without doing historical work, every time that I let myself dive into the work, there's a certain point in the work where I hit a point where I'm like, oh, here's something that I can look up. So I can take a break Like, so I start writing and then I could take a break at a certain point. And then when I need to verify something or look something up, that I can start a little bit of the research there, you know, and then get back to the work, you know, back to the writing part. So there's definitely, there's no hard rule, I think, for once you start working, you can't use Google anymore. I think you can always go back in and do more research.
Right. Definitely. Everyone has their own process. So just go with what your organic process is.
Exactly. Exactly. So talk about history and talking about terms that I've had to get used to. And I always bring this story up from Fabrice Sapolsky, who, when I first met, I'll never forget. I first met him and the first thing he said to me before I believe he even said hi was, no, it's not. What did I say? I said he was a New Era writer. And he said, no, it's not New Era. It's noir.
Yes, absolutely right.
And that was the first thing that he said to me. But one of the interesting things about that term and about that genre and about the time period that it comes from is that it kind of like I've never really had a hard definition. So talking about the Winterfeld, can you tell me what is your definition of that genre and tell us a little bit about Winterfields and where that's going to be set.
Sure. So the Winterfields is a graphic novel story about a father and son, and it takes place during the 1920s of the Harlem Renaissance. And Fabrice Sapolsky is the publisher, co-owner of Fair Square Comics. They're the publisher of Noir is the New Black, which is an anthology book with all Black creators. And so what's happening is, and you're hearing some vehicle with some booming sound system go right past my window. I live in Brooklyn. So this is part of the adventure. This is part of the adventure that happened.
Right.
And so Noir is the New Black is having an expanded edition come out. And the expanded edition has the 6-page introduction story of the Winterfields by myself, and Chris Cross is the illustrator and co-creator. And so when presented with that opportunity, because Fabrice was kind enough to invite Chris and myself to do the story for the expanded edition, one of the first things to think about is, okay, the book is called Noir is the New Black, right? So you have to do a story that speaks to that theme. And to me, noir means multiple things. Number one, there's film noir, right? Which is a particular cinematic stylistic genre of storytelling. And so you want something that visually evokes film noir. Noir is also a kind of tonal attitude in storytelling. There's not comedy noir, to my knowledge, right? It tends to denote something serious, mysterious, ground level, and speaking to how, you know, the definition has become even more expanded, speaking to the Black experience, right? And that experience as told by Black people, right? And one of the things is that our stories tend to be categorized, and those categorizations are what people see are as the breadth of Black life, of the Black experience, of Black history, and how that relates to global history. And so with the Winterfields, one of the things I really wanted to do was a crime noir story, right? For a number of reasons. Number one, I've never written a crime noir story before, but the comic books and graphic novels and novels that I love all speak to the genre. I'm a big fan of Walter Mosley, you know, Dennis Lehane, Greg Rucka, Lee Child. These people really are amazing storytellers. And when you're talking about comic books and graphic novels, you know, the preeminent crime genre team in North American comic books and graphic novels is undisputably
right.
Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. Right. My admiration of their work goes back to what I believe was their very first team up on a series called Sleeper for Wildstorm. And now Sleeper, you can find in an omnibus. It's 24 chapters because it was two 12-issue series that were broken up into seasons. Still one of my favorite crime noir stories in comics. Of course, I love the adaptations that Darwin Cook, God rest his soul, did for Donald Westlake's Parker character. So all the stories that you've seen IDW collect, right, in the different graphic novels and the different hardcover collections and slipcase, that's just amazing work. Things like that, going back to my time working as an editor on Batman and Greg Rucka and Sean Martinborough doing Detective Comics. It was during that time that we turned Detective Comics into a crime noir comic book. For a long time, Detective Comics had just been another Batman comic by another name. And all the Batman comics kind of felt the same.
Mm-hmm.
But when we relaunched the entire line, Detective Comics became a crime noir comic book.
Right.
Right. And so these things inspired me to do a crime noir story. I wanted to do a father and son story because, number one, you don't see that a lot in comic books.
Okay.
You don't see that a lot in fiction, especially a black father and son, right? You don't see that a lot. And so looking at that, looking at, you know, how I love the Road to Perdition film with Tom Hanks and Tyler Loughlin, directed by Sam Mendes, based off of a graphic novel by Max Allen Collins and Richard Pierce Rayner, Lone Wolf and Cub, these kinds of things, right?
Original.
And you can even say I was a little inspired by Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which, number one, not the best Star Trek series ever made, and number two, at the core, is a beautiful relationship with a father and a son, right? Which would then extend to the grandfather, but you had this amazing black family,
right?
At the core of this large political science fiction saga. And so I really wanted to make it a father and son story, and it's 6 pages, right? Yep. So you really don't have time to gab a lot. You don't have time to wait.
Right, exactly. Right? Exactly.
So you want to tell something that is really tight, but will hopefully make people want to see more of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think of the Winterfield 6-page introduction story as the cold open to a James Bond film.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Right. Think about it that way. Think about how the cold open to a James Bond film done correctly, and I would say this definitely applies to a number of the Daniel Craig films, that's a miniature story in and of itself.
Right.
But then once you go into the film and you watch more, you understand how that small story fits into the larger tapestry. And so the 6-page story of the Winterfield is going to be the cold open for the Winterfield graphic novel that is going to come out in 2025.
Right, right. Yeah. And I, you know, there is something about the art of this short story, man. I just think it's something that I keep reminding myself to work on more. I feel like it's one of those things that if you can master the short story art form, you can do like any type of story, because it really is, you know, I believe I was watching Neil Gaiman's master class, and he mentioned something about short stories. He mentioned your short story can be like, it's a self-contained story, but it could also be read as either the beginning of a story or movie or what have you, or the end.
Yeah.
And you want your readers or watchers to feel like, I want more, like this was satisfying, but I could do for more of that, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when I thought about writing this short story, I'll tell you what one of my big inspirations was. It was Batman Black and White.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an amazing series that former VP art director Mark Chiarello really spearheaded in the late 90s. And it had 8-page stories by some of the best creators in comic books. And the one that I loved the most was, it was a Two-Face story by Bruce Timm. I think Bruce Timm was the writer. I don't remember who the artist was, but it was this brilliant story about Two-Face being cured and finding some happiness and then losing it all tragically. And that was done in 8 pages. And I just thought about how Timm as a writer made those 8 pages an eternity, right? So it's really about thinking from a perspective of abundance as opposed to thinking of from a perspective of scarcity. Instead of saying, I only have 6 pages, you say to yourself, I have 6 whole pages. What am I going to do with these 6 pages, right? Mm-hmm. And you talk about the artwork. So Chris Cross, who is one of the best storytellers in North American comics, that's just a fact. That's not an opinion. But he and I, of course, in terms of business, we go back to the Milestone days. You know, I started Milestone in 1993. Chris was drawing Blood Syndicate. We actually go further back to the High School of Art and Design, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, Chris and I have known each other for 31 years in terms of business, and I've always wanted to work on something with him that was long form. We did a Dr. Light story for DC Comics back in the day, and that's when I wrote something to allow him to embrace his love of manga and anime.
Right.
And for this, what I really loved about it is he's never done crime noir either.
Right, right.
So for him, this was an exciting adventure and a challenge, but then he rose to the occasion. Right? And one of the things that writers of comic books and graphic novels will tell you is amazing artists make them look like better writers. Right? So whatever words I put down, he made those words look 3 times better.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And his storytelling is so thoughtful and it's emotionally evocative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I knew he was the right partner for it, the right, you know, kind of like collaborator. And then we just started jamming and figuring out, okay, what do these characters look like? What are their complexions? You know, what's their body language? And so it's a story that I think is going to surprise people a little, like mm-hmm. to see something like this come from both of us.
Right.
Whereas, you know, for the most part, the legacy of my career has been in the superhero genre.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, science fiction and fantasy working at Heavy Metal. And for Chris, you know, the thing about Chris is his career has really gone across genres.
Mm-hmm.
He did superheroes. He's done science fiction because he just finished a Mace Windu story for Marvel.
Right.
He's done horror. He did Shadow Man back in the day. Of course, he's done science fiction. He's done historical fiction for humanoids. So he's really gone across so many genres. So
mm-hmm.
it is amazing that I actually found one that he really never touched.
And that's...
But now he's going to be able to cross that off his list. And so it's really just a good, moody story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say too much about what it's about. I would like people to read it. But what I will say is, you know, Kane Winterfield, who the father is a bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
His son Carver is 10 years old. He's raising his son.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point about what Neil Gaiman said about how a short story can be the beginning or the end.
Mm-hmm.
This one is the end of a story.
Nice.
End of a situation that went sideways.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the consequences of something going sideways? And I really adopted the David Mamet philosophy of enter late and leave early. Right?
I got you.
But
yeah.
Don't come in a boring moment.
Of course.
Come in the moment right before an action that will pull you right in. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do here.
Right, right. Oh, that's such a good point. That's one of the things that I had to teach myself when I started writing was that I loved the idea of, you know, maybe it's because I was used to novels and stuff. I mean, I was reading comics too, but I don't know. My brain told me, well, I can't just throw them right into the middle of the stuff. You got to learn who these characters are. You got to do this. You got to do that. But I realized that every time I start something in the heat of the moment, like, you're going to solve the problem of knowing who this person is or who these characters are, because a character will reveal themselves when they're in their most stressful time.
100%.
And that's what they really are, right?
That's right. Like human beings.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly.
Like, your true nature reveals itself when you're in circumstances in which either you don't have a choice, mm-hmm. or in which your true nature is what you're going to need to survive.
Exactly.
Maybe it's the thing that you've been holding down inside you in a box so that you can navigate among normal people in society so that you can be invisible, but you're presented with a situation in which that thing that's deep down in you, you've got to pull it out.
Right, right, right.
Right? Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you went into that story with that approach. I mean, it's already exciting to read anything that you're putting out, but like knowing the mindset behind, again, that's what this podcast is for, is getting in the mindset about the writing process, you know? And so knowing that you took that approach is, I mean, honestly, I'm excited. I'm sure other people will be excited to check out Winsor Field. Field.
No, it's called the Winter Fields.
Yeah.
That's the last name. That's their surname.
Yeah.
It's called that for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say what the reason is, mm-hmm. but, you know, for me, when I make up names, right? Names are to make you think of something. They're to communicate something to you about the individual that has the name, right? Even if it doesn't particularly mean something, even the way it sounds, even the way it flows, right?
Right.
So there's particular intent behind that last name being the last name, you know, of this father and son duo, and, you know, the family of Winterfields going back
mm-hmm.
into the present. So this story takes mm-hmm. place in 1927, but there are ancestors and there are descendants.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the funny thing, I could be way off with this, but when I hear Winsor Fields and you're talking about the name and the meaning of the names, I'm thinking of fields, and I'm thinking about how fields, how do they hold up in the winter time? You know what I mean? They're not producing as much during that time. And then I'm also thinking about the time period. This is the 1920 kind of era,
yes.
after the World War One. And so,
yes.
Where Black people were, of course, there's still Black people working in fields, but during the slavery times were prior to that, where those. So I'm kind of picturing like there's like a history of, you know, the fields behind them to an extent, or something like that, something vaguely like it evokes a thought of a field with, you know.
that's interesting. So so I think you got an aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, to your point about slavery times, one of the things that I'm learning in reading the biography of Harriet Tubman mm-hmm. for the graphic novel that I'm writing mm-hmm. on her life for HarperCollins is not only the extreme conditions in which they had to work outside, but how they had to define seasons based mm-hmm. upon the changes in nature, based upon the changes in climate, right? You know, the slave masters did not have calendars, right, for the slaves.
Right, right.
Right? I mean, the slaves didn't even have proper rooms, right? They slept on the ground, right, during the cold months. the draft would come in, they had to cover themselves up or, you know, create warmth from fire in a pit, right? And so they were subjected to terrible temperatures, right, that we complain about now while we're wearing clothes that can insulate us. We right. complain about cold weather while we're wearing a down coat. We right. complain about the rain while we have an umbrella or while we have a poncho, right? But they had to work in the field no matter what.
Right.
Right? So you are onto something. And, you know, another reality is some family names are created.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're just passed along as the family name and no one knows the origin of the name.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? So there is a story to it. If, you know, the audience will allow it and want more and more and more of these two, then one day we'll tell the story.
And that's the great thing about storytelling is that when we're doing the work and the research in the background, there are so almost every story can be done. You can have more than just that one that maybe put out initially. There's probably the potential for so much more than whatever the first thing that put out, because it's so,
oh sure, because yeah. you kind of understand the character 360, right?
Exactly.
You don't understand the characters just in the context of the story you're telling now. You know them 360 and you can move them back and forth along a timeline.
And then there's different things, depending on the type of story you're telling, there's different things of your setting, your world. There's different problems your world could introduce. And you may not be able to tell that all in one story, but I recently had a situation now in something I've been writing recently where I had to tell myself, this is not working because this is not the time to tell it. Even though it fits really well into the story, this may have to be tabled for if there's a part two or something like that. Like
yeah.
particular issue.
Yeah.
And that's why there's just so much potential. Like stories are, like once you get into the nitty gritty of it, like you already know, there's just endless stories to tell. But yeah. I wanted to hit back really, really quickly on a few things I want to talk. So I'm gonna jump over to some things you said about genre and
okay, and
I'm gonna relate that to superheroes and storytelling as a whole. But sure. before I don't want to leave noir alone just yet. I want to ask one more thing about that. So
okay.
you mentioned something about the aesthetic of noir film, and I'm just curious between what you and Chris Cross are doing on this book. How would you describe, I don't know if you have pages or not, or if you guys just discuss things or whatever, don't reveal any of that, but what are you going for? What are you and Chris going for in terms of that that aesthetic on the actual page? So do you think there's a way to do the film type of feel on a comic page? And what do you think that would look like, et cetera?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, just to be clear, comic books are an amazing medium that have strengths that no other medium has.
Right.
So the goal isn't necessary to create, it's not necessarily to create a story that emulates film.
Right.
But it's to create a story that gives you the right tone. So essential in establishing the tone of noir is shadows and light.
Okay.
Right? The shadows are deep, the light is stark. Right. And what this does is it kind of reduces things to their basic nature. Right. Like, who are people when they're under pressure? Who are people when they're in peril? What is the drama of a moment? Like, really think about that. Like, what is the drama of a moment for any given human being? You have a point in which, if you go left, things go one way. If you go right, things go another way. And I think part of the core of noir stories is people making the more complicated decision and then living with that.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So when you talk about the father of the story, Cain Winterfield, it's funny you mentioned World War One because he's a World War One veteran. You come back from World War One, and you're still dealing with American racism.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yep.
And, he had to be able to find a way to make money that made sense for his skill set and to be able to clothe and feed his son. So he chose to be a bodyguard. Now, being a bodyguard means you are putting yourself in harm's way for other people again and again and again, which means you have to be able to take punishment. It means you have to go against the human instinct, and the human instinct is to avoid danger.
Right. Yeah.
Right. We're psychologically set up to run away from it. He has to run toward it. Right. That is partially informed by the fact that he was a soldier. He's been on the battlefield. He understands what that means. He understands constantly being on edge. Right. And so this job, during a really interesting time, because the different racial relations, the different social strata. So someone from down the block could hire you to be a bodyguard, and someone of means could hire you to be a bodyguard. And peril has different meanings for people like that.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So it's different things. And again, what this story is about is it's about what happens when something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Because that's where drama is, right? Drama isn't when everything is peachy keen.
Oh,
right.
We don't want those stories.
You know what? We may want them for ourselves, but we do not want
entertainment. Exactly. Exactly.
Entertainment, we want drama, right? Mm. And drama comes from, in part, walking the path of the bad decision.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I was when you said that, the romance popped in my head, and I was for a split second, I was thinking, people in romance like the peachy king, but then
no, they do not.
Exactly. Immediately, I was like, they want the drama. Yeah.
They want the affairs. They want the heat. They
right.
want the visceral emotions that would be considered uncivilized with your friends,
mm-hmm.
but like in your bedroom, you show what you're really made of.
Right.
You know, exactly. Who really wears the pants? Who really wears other things?
and that's so true. That's so true.
Like, oh, it's all happy and cool. It's like, no. Absolutely not.
And while I am not the biggest romance fan, I mean, I've read some stuff here and there, but my wife is a big romance fan, and I've seen the groups that she's in and some of the on Facebook and whatnot. And I'm like, okay, yeah, there's a large range of this stuff.
There's a large range. And you got to remember that romance is a genre, and within romance, there are subgenres.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
There's the spy romance. There's a historical romance. There's the military romance. One of the reasons why Jack Reacher, the character, the novels, the Amazon Prime show is so popular with women. Understand this. Women are the group that propelled Reacher to the status that he's in, right? Because Reacher's ex-military, right? So he's got that military energy, that discipline.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
But that's kind of like that stranger from a strange land romance,
mm-hmm.
right? The guy that just ends up in your town and is mysterious. And it's like, you know, he's trouble, but damn.
Right. Exactly.
Right. And that's how it goes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, romance cuts across a lot of different things. When the Uncanny X-Men was at its peak, it was a soap opera.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was a soap opera.
That's what made it,
right?
In my opinion, that's what made it so interesting. Like, there was like, yeah, it wasn't like superhero books. I was mentioning to somebody recently about the big superhero books, like the Justice League and Avengers and stuff. I'm like, oh, they're fun and, you know, whatever. But like the thing about the X-Men is the character relationships within that big group is what made it so interesting. You know what I mean? And the only other book I could think of that had that around, you probably know more than me, other big team books, but the Teen Titans, to another extent.
Marv Wolfman and George Perez's Teen Titan was the book that DC made that was a threat to Claremont, Byrne, and Uncanny X-Men because it was dead equal. It was a dead equal comic book on every level, man. Mm-hmm. But at the core of the new Teen Titans, you had multiple romances, right?
Exactly.
You had Robin and Starfire, right? Mm-hmm. You had Kid Flash and Raven.
Mm-hmm.
You had Victor Stone, Cyborg, and his girlfriend, Sarah, right? Then at a certain point, Terra came in and Changeling had a romance. Romance was all over the new Teen Titans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was an ingredient that you didn't see so much in the Justice League of America, which is why the Justice League didn't connect with people the way X-Men and Teen Titans did, right? Avengers dabbled with it some, Avengers kind of walked the line, but Uncanny X-Men and New Teen Titans,
They were
just full of sexual energy.
And it felt like they were about the people. So you got the romantic relationships, and then you have so when I think about team books, a lot of team books are big bad guy. We need the team to stop the big bad guy. They're more than that, but that's a general, that's the general line. World ending thing, cosmic, whatever. We have to stop the big thing. But those books dealt with interpersonal things while still in a team book. Now, solo books deal with interpersonal stuff, but they're solo because you should have more time to focus on, X character. But the team books, they the big threat. But in Teen Titans and X-Men, you had stuff, so you had the relationships like you just explained. And then you had Raven and her dad's Trigon,
That's right.
Deal with that. Then you got Cyborg and his dad. You know what I mean? And
that's right.
You got Garfield and how he's disconnected from his family is all because of his family status. So it's just all of these little things. And they focused on that versus in a lot of team books, you barely know anything about the characters, but they're so focused on the big threat that you get very little insight into their personal.
It's different. And I think another thing that's happening it's really tricky, the balance of internal narrative and dialogue, right? One of the things in doing the Winterfields is I really wanted to kind of thread the needle of the balance.
Yeah.
Right. So that you learn about the character on one level, but also on another level. Again, Ed Brubaker is one of the preeminent geniuses of this in North American comic books. Frank Miller on Daredevil Born Again.
Yeah.
Right. Just the way he went back and forth between first-person narrative and third-person narrative seamlessly, but you learn about Murdoch on two different levels, right? Seeing his deterioration internally and externally is really amazing. And so, that's part of it too. And going back to noir, there's definitely got to be sex and romance in noir, right? So you're going to see a little bit of that in the Winterfield.
Right.
We're going to touch upon a little of it right quick because, again, it's six pages, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make sure that you give the main three room to breathe.
Exactly. Yeah. And so talking about genre, so obviously we've talked a whole lot about noir, and none of that is, listeners will realize, is this is comics and it has nothing to do with superheroes,
That's right.
And then we went and we talked about a little bit about Teen Titans, X-Men, and then a tiny bit about Avengers and Justice League and stuff like that. There is I'll say maybe for the casual reader, even some less casual readers who read, who would call themselves big comic, and they are big comic heads. There's this idea of comics being about, it almost superhero is the genre for comics. And I push back against that so much. There's this there's this it always bothers me just a little bit. Not like, I know that they don't mean anything by it, but they, you know, I tell somebody I write comics or I make comics, and they go, well, who's your character? And and they're expecting me to, like, say some superhero name, I'm guessing. And I'm like, there are characters in the story, of course. but to me, the story is not it's about the character, but it's not like my character is Atom Man and Atom Man does this. It's more about, no, there's my character is this guy that is dealing with this situation.
Right.
You know, like in the Winterfields you mentioned, did I say it right? Fields.
Yes.
My tongue just wants to say Fields.
No worries.
In the Winterfields, it's a father in a son, you know, dealing with some tough situations. So if someone were to ask you who's your character, it's kind of like, oh, you're thinking of a superhero thing. And I kind of want to get your take on what you think about the idea of the superhero genre and its impact on comics overall, and where that is today. Because it wasn't, again, reading this history of American comics, the superhero thing was, it's very powerful in that, you know, through the history. But man, crime comics, especially before Stan Lee really hit it, like crime comics was like killing the scene. You know what I mean? Crime and horror. From what I
said, no doubt about it. I mean, what you had happening was, so superhero comics really came in the late 30s and the early 40s, and they were very useful during World War II because they were part of the American messaging, right?
Yeah.
You know, you would see, like, in a Superman comic, buy war bonds. And you would actually see footage of soldiers reading superhero comic books.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, what happened is, after the war ended, these soldiers came home, right? Their wives were in the workforce because the workforce had to continue while so many men were away fighting the war. So the wives became part of the workforce. When the war ended, soldiers came home, the wives went back home. People wanted to start families, and then suddenly they're not interested in superhero fantasies anymore. They're interested in real world stories, right? So they're interested in tales of romance. They're interested in tales of crime, and horror goes to the fears of the human experience, right? So as society's interest changed, the comic book changed with them. Superheroes came back in the 60s as a direct result of the Comics Code Authority.
Yep.
The Comics Code Authority basically decimated
crime comics.
Marvel Comics went from a company that did stories about monsters in titles called Amazing Fantasy and Tales to Astonish and Tales of Suspense. And then suddenly Amazing Fantasy introduced Spider-Man. Tales to Astonish introduced Ant-Man and the Wasp and Submariner. Tales of Suspense would introduce Iron Man and reintroduce Captain America, right? So the superhero genre goes back and forth, and I think part of that is societal responses. The interesting thing is now the superhero genre does not represent the majority of comic books. As a matter of fact, it's niche.
Right.
The reason people may think it's larger than it is because of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right.
Because the Marvel Cinematic Universe has introduced the vocabulary of superheroes to the masses.
And that's why I wanted to...
Comic book, they're thinking, oh, the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Mm-hmm.
In part because they aren't really told in an overt fashion that other things they like came from comic books and graphic novels.
Exactly.
The Nimona animated series that I think is on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
That's from the Nimona graphic novel by Noel Stevenson. We have The Return of Scott Pilgrim. That goes back to the original Scott Pilgrim graphic novel by Brian Lee O'Malley, right? Mm-hmm. I mentioned Road to Perdition, which is a crime film that came out in the early aughts. Again, that was based off of a graphic novel by Max Allen Collins and Richard Pierce Rayner. So people have no idea how many stories they're interested in come from graphic novels. A science fiction film called Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise Emily Blunt comes from, I believe, a manga called Die, right? That title is wrong. It's not Die. I think it's something like
It's either that or Kill
or something.
Yeah, I gotta look it up again. But yeah,
manga from Japanese graphic novels, and so that's part of what's happened is that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has led the masses to believe that the superhero genre is the dominant genre in North American comics. It's not. And certainly it's not the dominant genre in global comics, because when you talk about the French graphic novels, they create stories in basically any other genre but superhero.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They don't really originate a lot of superhero stories. They're dealing with Westerns. They're dealing with crime, slice of life, romance, science fiction, fantasy, horror. They're dealing with all the other genres, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, and that's why I was a little hesitant to say casual readers and not so casual, because I understand they may read a lot of comics in Marvel and DC specifically, but I'm like, man, they get surprised sometimes. Some people get surprised when I let them know, like, oh, I'm actually behind on Marvel. I don't really know what's going on. I've been checking out this other stuff from some indie creators and some you know,
that's where a lot of the exciting stuff is these days.
Right.
You know, if you come across a situation again where, you know, you say you write and draw comic books and someone says, well, who's your character? That's an opportunity to say, well, my character is such and such. Right. And They're like, oh, that's not a superhero. It's like, no, comic books are so much more than that.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. It's an opportunity to educate people in terms of the breadth of what's possible with comics. And to your point, not only are a lot of the more interesting stories happening outside of the superhero genre, but they're actually happening inside of the superhero genre when clever, talented writers kind of twist them around.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at The Human Target by Tom King and Greg Smallwood, they turned The Human Target, who is a bodyguard who exists in a superhero universe with the Justice League International, they turned that into a crime noir story, which became a murder mystery. So they basically created an Alfred Hitchcock type story deeply embedded in a superhero universe.
Right.
And they created a romance between a normal guy and a superhero, like a woman who is able to, you know, reduce the temperatures of things and create ice, right? So you can, within the superhero genre, create interesting stories that are not defined by that genre, right?
Yeah. And though, honestly, when it comes, I could be slightly jaded from reading comics for Marvel DC comics for so long. That those are the ones that interest me most. That's what I'm looking for when I pick up Marvel and DC stuff. I still love, I love comics of all forms. So I still read Marvel and DC stuff, but that's usually what I'm looking for. Something that is, can we go a little bit deeper than whatever the monster of the week? It is not really monster of the week anymore, like it was back in, you know, back in the 80s, 90s. But like, can we skip just big brawling fight? And can I get a story where we're talking about? Can I get Mr. Miracle? You know, can I get
Matt Fraction and David Ott.
Yeah, there you go. Can I get Hawkeye? Can I get even Runaways from 2003?
First of all, anything that Brian on, right?
Exactly.
So that's number one. But also, what did he do? He subverted within the genre, right? So basically, his premise was, when you're young, you think that your parents are terrible people. Well, what if they really
were? What if they really were?
What if your parents were really the supervillains of the world? What the hell would you do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the powers are just this kind of ingredient to contextualize a story about young people who have to reframe everything they think about their parents, about their families, about their best friends' parents, and about what is good and evil in the world.
Right, right.
Right? Yeah. So it's a story about coming of age. That's what Runaways is. You could take the powers away and you could still do Runaways. This person can't necessarily, I don't know, they're not necessarily a mystic, but they are a multi-billionaire.
Right, right. Yeah, and, right? And I believe that's the key. Like when people come to me and they say, I've got this story. You know, I got this guy with he's basically a firebender. It's like, okay. But yeah, I want the story when you take the powers away. Who is this person when he's not a firebender? Who's this person when they don't teleport or when they're not Superman level? Like who are these people? And that's what I'm looking for and don't get me wrong, because of the times, you know, as time moves on, audience demand more from Marvel and DC. So yeah, a lot of the solo stories and Marvel, there's been some Immortal Hulk. Hulk story that is...
Immortal Hulk is great. Immortal Hulk is a horror story.
Incredible. Right. Exactly. Just absolutely incredible. It's like that a take on Hulk that is I would have never thought of, you know. Still talking about Hulk when they did the run on Jen, a shorter run, but they did the Jen run where she was dealing with depression and the Hulk was a kind of a representation of dealing with that, you
right.
know. Like stuff like that where you get into what is this story about? Sans the powers, like the powers are another element to the story.
Right,
they
right.
aren't the story,
right?
You know,
right.
And that's the kind of storytelling that I'm looking for. But yeah. So, what do you think about where sans the MCU and stuff like that? Current comics. So we'll go from 2020 to 2024. Since when was Endgame? 19, right? So yeah, from 2020 to 2024, and then going back, you know. Even further to what you've seen since you've been in the industry for the last 30 years. Where do you think comics are now and how is it shifting and where do you think it's kind of going?
So it's a large question because there's never been a greater diversity of different types of comics than there is now in the present in terms of genre, in terms of creative visions, in terms of creative ownership or co-ownership and profit participation in terms of formats, right? We have web comics now, which is a true major economic force and boom, right? So you have floppies, you have digests, you have graphic novels, you have omnibuses and compendiums. And then multiple languages. There is so much diversity. The bigger issue is the economics of the industry and how that impacts the creators and how creators have to start becoming entrepreneurs. Because historically, artistic people have been brainwashed into believing that they are labor only. And the reality is each creative person is an independent company and they have the capacity to run their career like a business. And they have the capacity to understand that the value of their work is not just defined by the first set of rules that you're told.
Right.
This is a core issue now. That core issue has extended itself among a number of creative industries. We just came last year out of the confluence of the Writers Guild of America strike and the Screen Actors Guild strike. You've seen unionization to an unprecedented level in the last 2 years. Interestingly enough, what are you now seeing? You're seeing tons of layoffs. Is there a correlation? I imagine there is. Let's see. You have a bunch of people that fought for their rights, and then you have a bunch of people who are being let go from their jobs, right? Should we believe that there's no connection? Of course there's a connection, right? But again, creative people have to understand their value and really think about how they want to navigate the comic book industry, because they may love comics and comics are amazing, but the business is a business. The business does not have affection for them. The business right. is not a nice, caring person that will hug them in times of need, right? The business is a business, and it operates by the rules of capitalism, and in some cases, yeah. middle capitalism. And so people just really have to think about their positioning and their opportunities and what they have to offer as creators. And part of that takes a realistic assessment of your talent and the right. desire, the strong desire to
contribute. Yeah, the passion. I was going to ask about the passion.
Some of it also take your capacity to hustle, your mm-hmm. capacity to negotiate yourself in situations, because quite frankly, if we were a society in which talent determined success or failure, this would be a fundamentally different world in which we'd be living. So we know that's not the only factor,
right?
It's a good nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great nucleus, but you need to learn about business. You need to learn about negotiating. You need to understand that it all comes down to mutually beneficial relationships. You have to know your temperament and know yourself. You have to be able to work with people, right?
Yeah.
And so when I look at comic books, that's the core issue now, is the creator and the business and the reconciliation of both of those things. Now, when you're talking about comics from when I started, which was in 1993, so that was the beginning of Milestone Media. Milestone Media, the Black-owned publisher of a truly inclusive superhero universe for the first time, something that DC Comics, even though their superhero universe started in 1938 yep. with Action Comics number one and Superman and Marvel's, you could say it went back to 1939 with mm-hmm. Marvel Mystery Comics one, because that yeah. was becoming the World War II mythology with the invaders and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. you had these Titan companies, decades old mythologies, but still, for the most part, homogenous in terms of cultural representation, in terms of the representation of sexual orientation, in terms of all of the characters being able instead mm-hmm. of characters with, you know, disabilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Milestone's Dakotaverse, their superhero universe, was the first universe to really reflect the diversity of right. humanity. And so from that point, when Milestone was unique in that way, to now 31 years later, you see considerably more representation, the characters, you see so many more creators of color, queer creators, disabled creators, women creators, creators across the whole gender identification spectrum.
Right.
Being given opportunities to write for the big companies,
mm-hmm.
the opportunity to create their own
right.
ideas and get published. And so a lot of progress has been made in the last 31 years, mm-hmm. but we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah,
absolutely. We have a lot of work to do as an industry. And what's good is you have a lot of creators now. They're not asking for permission to get into Marvel and get into DC. They're making their own book.
Yeah.
They're making their own books. They have publishing houses which are being funded through crowdfunding.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? And then they're getting recognized by the bigger houses. If you look at someone like Roy Akupe,
oh yeah,
right, mm-hmm. and how he created all of his books, right, Ayana, Child of Wonder, and EXO, and Malika Warrior Queen, and was creating high quality books for years. And Dark Horse saw that.
Right.
And now he has a publishing deal with Dark Horse.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So, but that was him charting his own path. And when you're talking about business, companies respect people that chart their own paths because they see that you can achieve success without them.
Right.
And they actually want a piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
They want to take your success and they want to fuse it with their resources.
Right.
And create something bigger than both of them separately, right? So the capacity to produce and create and continue to create, make things of quality, put them out into the world,
mm-hmm.
that is something that is highly respected.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people will talk and talk and talk, but proportionately, very few people do.
Yeah, which way
to do. Then fewer people do it with quality. Mm-hmm. And then fewer people do it consistently.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right? And then fewer people do it because they love comics. But that's a whole mm-hmm. other concept.
That is. Right? That is.
About comics for comics' sake.
Mm-hmm.
And comic being pimped for other generation, but that's a whole other.
Yeah, we've seen that. We've seen that. Man, it's, I was thinking about when I was putting some comics in some boxes not too long ago, and I was like, wow, just a few years ago, I'll say like 5+ years ago, I was mainly wrapping up, you know, stuff from the comic shop, and well, longer than that, I'm thinking about maybe like 2017 ish, and now more and more, I'm like, wow. And I'm thinking about, so here's me, like the picture of me as a kid looking through my dad's old comics and picking up random old issues of Spider-Man or grabbing this big Spawn, which I should not have been reading. Spawn is not a children's book by any means.
It's not.
But I was a child reading that book. but anyways, I remember like just grabbing these, you know, big publisher books from this box. And then as I'm packing these books up that are a lot of indie books, things from people like Danny Quick and things from people like Kerry Randolph and stuff and Brandon Thomas and you know, Roy, like you mentioned, like packing these books up and thinking like, wow, so my kids are gonna, you know, my kids who are getting interested in reading this stuff now, they're gonna be picking through these books and they're gonna see these indie books, as opposed to me saving mainly Marvel and DC. And
that's right.
Back in the day. Right. And it's so interesting to me that it's changed. Like these are the, I value these books. Like, I mean, again, I am not putting down Marvel or DC books by any means. It is what it is. But when I think about like the books that I'm excited to be packing up, it's usually these indie books or these titles that are like standalone, some creative thing that somebody thought of, like Ram V's Death of, what was it? The Many Deaths of Layla Starr, I believe it was.
That's right. That's
stuff
right.
Stuff like that. When I read a good series like that, or The Me You Love in the Dark, I believe that was Scotty Young and
yes,
for her. It's stuff like that. And I'm like, this is the stuff that I'm excited to be putting this in my box and hope one of my kids or somebody, you know, grabs it out later on and just peruses through it, you know?
Yeah. It all depends on what you like. And I think what your children learn from your choices. Well, what are the things that interested you? For my father, it was Sergeant Rock, Scalp Hunter. So he liked Westerns. He liked military, Jonah Hex, things like that. Deathlok, the Demolisher. He liked those kinds of characters. It all depends on what interests you. And you're talking about Marvel and DC. No shade to Marvel and DC because
mm-hmm.
we got, you know, the whole Jonathan Hickman X-Men reboot.
Oh yeah.
At Marvel Comics. Like,
right.
Let's be clear. So no shade to that. Or we got Superman Lost
mm-hmm.
by Christopher Priest and Carlo, I think it's Pagulian, at DC Comics. You know,
so right, right.
No shade to them. Like, these houses are capable of the versatility to tell amazing stories. But again, even though for the direct market, Marvel and DC combined control about 65% of the market, the direct market isn't all of comic books.
Right, exactly.
Even the direct market is kind of niche in relation to all the comic books and all the graphic novels. And so it's really just about finding what you like from wherever it's from, whatever publisher, read that, right? And then, you know, if you pass it on, if your children inherit it or whomever inherits it, they get a sense of what you are interested in based upon the stuff that you read.
Yeah, yeah. And it is so interesting now. Like, I just thought another one, Samurai Grandpa. So interesting now. I was like, people, well, what publisher is that for? Oh, it's creator owned. It's owned by this person. The guy, the guy's name that you see on the book right here, he published it himself, you know?
Right.
So it's so different now. But then you have, of course, I want to get your last thoughts on what do you see the state of comic book fans and what fans as a whole? What have you, from your perspective, what do they want? I know we've got some groups of people who are, I don't know if the upset's the right word about, oh, comics are changing, or they're not what they used to be, or they're not like they were in the 90s, or whatever it is they want, which I'm not, some of these groups, I'm not sure what they want exactly. Because those types of comics that they say that they still want are still out there. So it's kind of confusing when they say that, oh, well, comics is changing. But do you feel like that it's changing, or do you feel like it's expanding? Or what are your thoughts on that?
So first off, there is no way in God's green earth that I can answer a question about the nature of comic book fans in 5 minutes. This is what I think at the core, honestly, at the core, I think comic book fans want validation. I think they want validation of self, right? I think they want their fiction to meet their needs.
Okay.
Right? Different people have different needs. For some people, the need is, I wish the world was the way it was when I was a teenager. And so the books that I want now need to reflect that. The world has changed to a point where I don't recognize it, and maybe I don't like it so much. So I don't want books that represent a world that I'm not comfortable with. I want books that represent a time that my needs were met.
Okay.
Right? For other people, they want to know that they're not alone in the world. And they want to read stories about people who are just as complicated and nuanced and potentially contradictory and in pain, private pain, as they are. Because it reminds them that they're not alone in this world, that their pain is not a solitary pain. It's a pain within humanity, right? Now, I'm crazy in the sense that I'm pretty comfortable with change.
Yeah.
So I've grown up on superhero comics, but I love when something gets shaken up.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Like take me out of the comfort zone. As long as you take me into a journey with characters that I give a damn about.
Yeah, make it interesting.
Yeah, so that's me. I am not the common fan by any stretch of the imagination. And I also think at the core, we all want good stories. We may have different opinions of what constitutes a good story, but we all want good stories. We want entertainment that speaks to us on a personal level.
Right.
Right. So that's where I think is the commonality of the comic book fans.
Right.
The divergence occurs when people use their emotions to hurt other people.
Yeah, yeah.
The divergence comes when you have the gift of life and you have the gift of time, and you decide that the best things that you can do with your life and your time are defecate on the works of others and harass other people and communicate your anger at how the world is changing. But because you can't hit the world, you hit a writer.
Yeah.
You hit an artist. You hit creators of comic books that you wish you could write and you wish you could draw. But because you don't have that opportunity, you're going to attack other people. And the honest truth is, within all of that are nuanced conversations about stories, corporate management of intellectual property, core fan bases, things like that. But because of things like social media, we're losing the ability to have nuanced, civil, respectful conversations about differences of opinion. And conversations become immediately incendiary, immediately toxic. That's a big problem.
All right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. 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 I mean, you hit the nail on the head in terms of especially the people who want to attack people for putting a certain type of workout. I really have never understood that, because it's like, just read something. It feels so narrow, especially when we're talking about comics. It feels narrow because it's like, you're getting upset about this person making an indie fantasy comic about something else over here, and you don't even read fantasy. You know, it's like, what?
Well, again, it's emotional, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not necessarily about the thing, but it's about how you feel, right? So that's what it is. It's like, this makes you feel a certain way, and you lash out at it. Quick, fast, because of social media, you don't have to think about discretion.
Right.
You don't have to think. You can react fast. Yep. Right. And so we've become so reactionary that we've lost the immediate capacity to be considerate, to be thoughtful, or to your point, just to avoid that which we don't like.
Right.
And engage that which we do. So if you don't like the present state of the industry or the product, then go collect a bunch of the old stuff in collections.
Right. Yeah.
I've been doing that to some degree. I've really been gravitating towards books that have come out 10 years ago or 20 years ago because the art was so amazing. Because writers and artists were coming together for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something to learn from. Like I said, you know, my favorite Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips graphic novel is Sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was their first one almost 20 years ago.
Right.
It's by no means their best,
mm-hmm.
but there's something about it, about that early work, about them coming together, about working on something when you don't know how much longer you have.
Right, yeah.
Right? Versus now, when you know, anything you put out in the market, automatic sell. You yeah. have a fan base. But mm-hmm. when you were producing something and you didn't know, like, you could have been canceled the next issue, you produce in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You have a different mindset, right? It's always about quality, but the quality comes with these other emotions. And so
yeah.
I'm learning from earlier works. I'm learning from, you look at my shelf, there's Barry Windsor Smith's Monsters, which was like this big 30-year magnum opus, which is the end of his career in comics, which is a tragedy.
Mm.
And Barry Windsor Smith has been a gift to the comic book medium and industry. But then you have Weapon X.
Right.
Weapon X, which is like 30 years old,
mm-hmm.
but the impact of which will never be undone on X-Men, Marvel, or Disney ever, ever, ever.
But
think about the difference of the man
mm-hmm.
between one of those books and the other book.
Right. Yeah.
Right. But that's it. So that's an interesting study.
Yeah. 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 That, I mean, it makes me think about music too. Like,
100%.
And today, Ludacris and stuff like that, you know?
I'm listening to the hip-hop of the 90s more and more these days. Like, when I need a boost,
mm-hmm.
I get a boost from Method Man. I get a boost from
Tribe
Called Quest, right? I'm not getting that boost from some of the people now. Part of the reason is generational, and I'm looking for something that speaks to me. And part of it is just like, things are changing, right? I saw an article I didn't read it, but the headline was, hip hop is 50 years old. Is it still radical? Right?
Is it still
radical? And to me, it's like, you don't, that's a clickbait question. You don't really mean that.
Right, exactly.
Because we know what the answer is, and there's a lot of reasons why, and we mm-hmm. can have that conversation. But you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. that's the thing. So to me, it's, if what exists now doesn't meet your needs, then go seek out the work that did, because the wonderful thing is a lot of it is collected in books, soft cover books, hardcover books, or digitally. You can get entire libraries on your iPad. It's like,
oh yeah, the digital world is insane.
Exactly. So just find what you love instead of attacking people who produce what you don't.
Exactly. Last point I'll make real quick on your last comment about the radicalism of hip hop. I'll bring that back to comics for a second. I've seen the internet conversations about why are you trying to push this into comics, and why are you trying to push that into comics, and comics are supposed to be just fun stories and blah, blah, blah. And again, the more I consider myself, I'm a very humble minded person. I remind myself that I don't know anything. But I also know that I don't know. I also know that I know something. and when I look at the history of comic, and again, reading this is not the first history of comic books that I've read, but reading the most recent history of comic book, I keep looking. I'm like, comics were never just, they were always fun, but it was never just, there was always a story somebody was trying to tell. You mentioned earlier in the military times with the war bond, there was a message, there was an intent, there was a, whether it be marketing or whether it be the writers in / artist emotion, whether it be there's a era in there where they're talking about the illustrators who were both a lot of the time the writer and illustrator who they went through the whole drug phase, and they're like, and they were open about it. They would talk about, no, I get high and do the, not that I'm not condoning drugs by any stretch. I'm just talking about the history. But yeah, I get high, and then on my down, whatever they called it, my down spiral, that's the twilight time to draw and write, you know, and the emotions that come out of that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
mm-hmm.
all these different areas of why people write. So when somebody simplifies it to, oh, I just want my stories to be fun, just give me some monsters and guys killing the monsters, I just shake. Is that really all you want to read? You know, is that really what, I don't think that's ever what comics has ever been solely, you know. I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, you know, it goes back to comfort zones, and, you know, to take it back to the front, part of the reason that I wanted to do the Winterfields, a crime noir story, is because mm-hmm. that's not my comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah.
That's stepping outside my comfort zone, but in that place, I will be able to discuss things about the Black experience, which are of high importance to me.
Right.
And have high significance to 20th century American history. Mm-hmm. Right. Being able to have the honor of writing the Harriet Tubman graphic novel for the middle grade age demographic is telling this story about a woman who became a liberator, but how just as a young girl, she had to endure so much, right? Like, people don't really know the definition of adversity these days. And younger people could really learn from the adversity that someone like Harriet Tubman had to live through as a young girl before she could become the adult liberator, right? I've done a horror story that's going to come out from Ahoy Comics in March for a series they have called Project Cryptid. And I wrote a story that connected to my Jamaican American heritage.
Hmm.
And being a resident in Brooklyn, right? Because again, horror is outside of my comfort zone. So it's right. Like, okay, let me go there. What can I do in that area outside of my comfort zone that has some kind of personal connection that hopefully will resonate with other people, right? Hmm. So I think it all comes down to whether an individual is willing to be outside of their comfort zone to learn more, or do they only want to live in the world of their comfort zone?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and whoever that person is, that determines what they're looking for in entertainment, that determines what they're looking for in the world, and that may even determine their capacity and willingness to change as people, as opposed to just staying the same because of obstinate.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Man, that's what I love about stories. I love the diversity of stories, whether it be comics, novels, etc.
100%. They're our food.
Yeah.
Stories are our sustenance. We need them mm-hmm. to inspire us and to keep us moving forward. So we're creating our own sustenance the same way that we grow our own food.
Yeah. And that's all we need. I know I brought up Ram V once already, but to definitely the star, but it hit me so hard because I never thought about death in that way. You know what I mean?
You do.
It was just so like, when I put it down, I was just like, wow, that, like, this is why we need other people telling stories, you know, or just, this is why I like to go and check out other people's different types of stories, no matter how, like, distance from what I usually read it might be, because they're so interesting. You never know what you'll find, you know?
Yeah, you have to.
A random title sometimes, like, just the most random, I don't know what this is, but let me just read an issue of it and see how I feel about it, you know? And a lot of the time I find something that's interesting in some way.
Yeah. That's part of the fun, part of the
right.
taking a risk.
Exactly. Okay, so last thing here. Where would you like to say to, we talked about a lot about the comic industry and where it is now, and we talked about the job of a writer to an extent, you know? And so what would you like to say to comic creators who are creating in today's era of comics? You know, because it's different from where I was 30 years ago. So, just any last thoughts on that? Any inspirational words? And then you can give your socials and when future books come out, like Fields areas.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I cannot promise to inspire. But what I will say is this. Treat the business aspect of your career with the same level of seriousness and passion that you treat the artistic aspect of your career. If you can do that, then that will definitely open the door to having a career that gives you different types of fulfillment and meets your needs and can set you up for a future of prosperity. Right? In terms of the Winterfield, so that is a 6-page story in the expanded edition of Noir is the New Black, which is a graphic novel anthology by Black creators. It's published by Fair Square Comics, right? Fair Square Comics is a publisher that is dedicated to creator-owned publications by a wide variety of creators. And so that is about to drop, and Chris Cross and I are really excited to see what people are going to think of the Winterfields, because again, it might surprise them a little bit.
Yeah.
A little ski. And that's something that you'll be able to find in comic book stores. It will start showing up in bookstores in the middle of February, and then you can also go to the Fair Square Comics website if you like and inquire about how you can get a copy if you're not in an area where a comic book store is nearby. And in terms of where you can find me on social media, I am Joe Illidge on Facebook, Joseph P. Illidge on Twitter/X, Joseph P. Illidge on Blue Sky, and IllMaster1 on Instagram.
Awesome. And for everybody, first of all, Fabrice Sapolsky, if you guys are wondering who that is, you guys should know who he is because he was on episode 33 of this podcast. So go back to episode 33, listen to me and Fabrice chat it up where Fabrice pretty pretty much eviscerates the mainstream comic industry in favor of indies, which I'm all for good reason. He has a lot of good stories, some horror stories, but he does some good breakdowns of why indie is important.
Well, if you've been in comics long enough, you have some horror stories.
Of course, yeah. definitely go follow Joe Illich on all the social media. Again, this is a legend in the comic sphere. Was there pretty much at when it comes to Milestone Comics, like that's the start of an era right there, in my opinion. Milestone was the start of era.
Definitely.
That was the first, Static was the first comic that I picked up and realized, oh snap, I'm black. I remember young little me trying to figure out why Static was speaking to me, even though I love Spider-Man. And I'm like, oh wait, this kid's black. And his mom sounds like my mom when she's yelling at me to get in the house or whatever, you know? definitely hope you guys enjoyed this episode. You can find Beyond the Fourth Wall on all major podcast hosts, iTunes, Stitcher is now gone. You guys remember Stitcher no longer exists, but iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, which I believe is turning to like YouTube Podcasts or something like that soon. Anyways, you search and you'll find it. Thanks again, Joe, for coming on again. I really appreciate it. And we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.